Welcome to Holden Village. Today, in the fabulous Fireside Room, today's speaker is Michael Pellett, and he will be speaking on pyramids and clover leaves. So let's listen in on Michael.
My name is Michael Pellett, and I teach theology at the Lutheran Seminary in Saskatoon, Saskatchewan, Canada. And one of the areas of theology that I'm interested in and that I teach are theologies of liberation. And I'm particularly focused in that area in some of the things that are going on in Latin America. And so one of my interests in Latin America and liberation theology, what I try to do every 2 or 3 years is through the Center for Global Education at Augsburg College in Minneapolis. I'm a group leader that gets seminarians and pastors and any other interested people who would like to join us to go for a 2-week travel educational seminar, kind of an immersion experience seminar, into different areas of Central America to investigate different issues. And I did that again the last 2 weeks of June, and we went to Nicaragua and Guatemala, and particularly were concerned with the role of the church in items of social justice with respect to land reform, issues of conflict resolution, and work with the indigenous peoples. Those were kind of the 3 key areas that I focused on this time for this seminar and this tour. And so what I'd like to do in the sessions this week is discuss some of the issues, at least as they were at the present being discussed in Nicaragua and Guatemala, and also engage in some theological reflection on that to see what we as Christians in North America might learn from some of these experiences in the southern part of the hemisphere and particularly in Central America, and what that means for us. The title for today's session is kind of cryptic, Pyramids and Clover Leaves. But what it is intending to describe are 2 ways of structuring or organizing a society. Certainly the kind of pyramid structure is of no surprise or nothing new to anyone, that often has been the kind of structure of hierarchy and usually of domination and oppression. I want to talk about the kind of pyramid structures that are operative in Guatemala and Nicaragua, and then also talk about what, for lack of a better name, I've called a clover leaf, because it's kind of four circles that interlock with one another, and if you try to draw them out perhaps or try to remember them, it might be a sense of a clover leaf, to see what at least some groups in both Guatemala, Nicaragua, elsewhere in Central America, elsewhere within church movements and other political movements are describing as a way of organizing and structuring their society, culture, way of living together. So first of all, let me begin with the pyramids. And again, how the pyramids seem to be structured in the two countries. And they're structured a bit differently. I'll work with Guatemala first. If we have the pyramid again, and obviously those on the top are the ruling, those in control, power, domination. Those on the bottom are the ones who are subjugated, oppressed, exploited, and so on. Within Guatemala, the bottom group are the indigenous peoples. And in Guatemala, these peoples are basically of Mayan heritage and descent. There are the different kinds of Mayan tribes. There are the Quiché, the Quetzalcoatl, and others like that. But these are the indigenous peoples that find themselves on the bottom. These are the peoples that, at least historically, even within the church at the time of the conquest, it has always been debated whether or not they even have souls. So you can see the issue there is whether or not they are even human beings. Back in the middle of the 16th century, the debate goes on before the court of the Holy Roman Emperor and the Pope between Bartolomé de las Casas and Juan Ginés de Sepúlveda, precisely on the question of whether the indigenous peoples, the Indians of the New World, have souls. Bartolomé de las Casas, who is seen as one of the first advocates of the people, tries to argue that indeed they do. And Ginés de Sepúlveda argues that they do not. Guess who won? It was decided that indeed these indigenous peoples do not have souls. And because they do not have souls, therefore they are not as fully human as people of European stock. And so therefore it is indeed proper for those within the conquista, within the conquest of that new world, to treat these indigenous peoples as beasts of burden. And within the writings of the time, they are often compared to donkeys or horses. And in fact, many times, a fine horse is worth far more than one of these human beings. It would be far worse to lose a horse than it would be to lose 10 or 20 of these people working down in a silver mine or working out on the plantation. So that these people literally at this point can be understood as beasts, and beasts of burden. Right? They have human bodies, but it's not quite sure that they indeed have human souls. And even today, like 500 years later, or 450 years later, after that decision is made, one sees within the stratification of society that those here within the upper echelon still basically understand and treat the indigenous peoples, perhaps one couldn't say as beasts anymore, but certainly as inferior. And certainly that's why, right, when it comes to issues of justice, many within this upper echelon do not see what's all the fuss about, that these indigenous peoples are just scraping by, subsistence level existence, merely surviving, are clamoring and complaining for land and justice. They really don't deserve it, because after all, look at who they are. They're perhaps no longer understood as subhuman, but certainly they are inferior human beings. And so the whole setup within society reflects and mirrors that. And again, particularly, this is very strong yet within Guatemala. The next level above the indigenous peoples would be called the Ladinos. And even in here, one might put the Campesinos. These are not indigenous people solely, but these are the mixtures of the Spanish with indigenous peoples. They have more of a Spanish-speaking heritage and culture. They are still often very poor within society. They are often the artisans within society. They run the small markets, the small shops, crafts, and so on and so forth. But they are still above the indigenous peoples, but still very much within this poor level and poor strata in society. Next comes those that are of the middle class. And again, within Central American countries, the middle class is often a very small group of people. And so here too in Guatemala, there is a middle class, but it's a small group of people. Professional people, doctors, lawyers, again, better shopkeepers, merchants would comprise that middle class, but it's quite small. Next, in the order of power at least, would come the government. These are those that are supposedly elected. Those are the ones that supposedly run the affairs of the country, that sit in the governmental palace, pass and make the laws from the president, his various ministers, on down to those people who are the representatives. But again, they're not the most powerful and the ones that make the decisions. At the next level, above the government, and this is always somewhat open for debate, are the military and the wealthy. And the wealthy have bonded together in a coalition that's known as CACIF. And this is the old money. This is again comprised of a few families, 15, 20 families, in which the key wealth of Guatemala is concentrated. It used to be, at least from their perspective, in the good old days, that the wealthy were above the military. In fact, the military was basically the wealthy's private enforcement army and police to get what they wanted done within the country. But since the United States has taken a more active interest in Guatemala, and this is particularly since 1954, what happened in 1954 is that within Guatemala there was a reform movement going on, and a person by the name of Arbenz was elected as president. And what Arbenz wanted to do was to nationalize some of the foreign capital investments, like the banana plantations of United Fruit and some of the other businesses, as well as engage in land reform, secondly, and thirdly, a process of democratization with the people. The United States found that unacceptable. So in 1954, President Eisenhower signs an order, and in conjunction and through the CIA, they engaged in a military coup, which overthrew the Arbenz government and established a military dictatorship. And basically from 1954 through to 1986, Guatemala has been governed by different military dictatorships, because the military has been governing the country for the last 30 years and has primarily now gotten their money from the United States, not the wealthy of the country itself. The military has been able to kind of assert its own autonomy from these wealthy within the country, and therefore has been able to kind of rise up in their own status and power. And so that now within Guatemala, there is this kind of cooperative yet competitive coalition between the military and CACIF in running the country and calling the shots. And again, the best way of noting this cooperative movement within the country is to see that those within the military, particularly the upper level generals, are respectable enough such that the daughters of the wealthy can now marry the sons of these military generals, or vice versa, the sons of the wealthy can marry the daughters of these military generals. And so, of course, once being related by marriage, the coalition has been solidified. So this is the ruling group within the country where the power is concentrated. Then, of course, at the very top of the pyramid is always that interesting question in terms of how much control and enforcement does the U.S. government play in all of this? And is Guatemala truly a self-ruling country, or does it still by and large have to bow to the whims, the intentions, the will of the United States? Right? And that's always a big political issue and debate. If you want my cynical point of view on this, I think that by and large the U.S. government still calls the shots and controls what goes on and is very much involved in a coalition with both the Guatemalan military and with the wealthy of the country.
Can you say a little bit, having been there in June, about the last year? I forget the person's name who became the new president, but he had been like a human rights commissioner, and there was some hope that things would change, but the last I heard, he didn't seem any more effective than Syriza.
The new president is, his last name or his name is Carpio. And he was the minister for human rights within the Guatemalan government and was very popular and well respected by the people. Simply because, again, to be involved in human rights, you're kind of outside of this structural pyramid of and power. You're kind of hovering out here around the edges and saying, look at this is a violation of human rights here. This is a violation here. Very often, you can't do much to change things, but what you can do is at least name the violation, which is a first and important step to say, here is where there are violations. So there was great hope among the people when Carpio was elected. But unfortunately, what happens is that when you are elected, right, you are drawn into, or one might even say, sucked into this system and into this structure. And in order to survive, you either adapt and adjust to that structure, or you'll be out. Right? And it'll simply be a coup and you're gone. And that's the recognition here that, again, Carpio has had to adjust to this and has fit into this structure. Why do most people say this is the case? They say this because one of the first things that he did, and what was seen as terrifically significant politically, and sent a message to all the people in the country and to those elsewhere, is that he named as his Minister of Defense the key military general. Now, what does it mean when the Minister of Defense, which supposedly, again, right, within most democratic countries, is a civilian position, is now that of the key and most powerful military general in the nation? That means that you have, right, someone up here in this power structure intimately involved in the government cabinet and calling the shots. And so most people are very skeptical as to whether or not Carpio makes any decisions whatsoever in terms of ones that are truly important, but that indeed he is the spokesperson for the military Kasif coalition, which gets their way and intentions known through the Minister of Defense, General Enrique. And so that, because of that appointment, key appointment, and things that have followed from that, most people, particularly right from here on down, have been very disappointed in what Carpio has done, simply because they've recognized again that that structure and that system has taken over. And so he can try to be, to use this kind of George Bush phrases, kind of kinder and gentler in the way he exercised that pyramid structure of power. But the structure will not change. That becomes clear. In Nicaragua, the peoples that are on the very bottom are the peoples of the Atlantic coast. Nicaragua, in many respects, is two different countries, or you can go into two different worlds, and it's divided by the mountains in the middle that act almost on a spine, as a spine. On the west coast, the Pacific coast, is where one has what we basically assume Latin American cultures to be like. They are Spanish-speaking, and they have adopted and adapted most of the Spanish-speaking customs and mores and behaviors and so on and so forth. That's where Managua is located. That's basically the central government and the power base within Nicaragua. On the Atlantic coast and the peoples of the Atlantic coast, it's a far different situation. The primary language there is English, because part of the peoples that settled that coast were the Creole peoples, which were, again, escaped slaves from Caribbean colonies, from slave ships, sometimes even from North America. And so these black escaped slaves settled all along the Caribbean coast, in places like Nicaragua, Honduras, so on and so forth. So that these are the primary peoples here. It is a black culture. It is an English-speaking culture. As well, the indigenous peoples on this coast have been able to maintain their identity. Like the Miskito Indians, the Sumos, the Rama, and the Garifuna. And in my third session on Thursday, when I talk about indigenous cultures, I'll talk more about these people and the different cultures that they bring there. But these are the peoples of the Atlantic coast. Again, not Spanish-speaking in their orientation and culture. As well, in terms of church, these peoples are basically Protestant, not Catholic. The area in terms of where the missionary activity happened among these blacks and the Miskito Indians, which is the predominant tribe in the area, were Moravian. And so the Moravian church is the predominant church in the area. It's the Protestant church in the area, not the Catholic church. So we have, again, predominantly English-speaking peoples with a Protestant culture. To go to the east, to the Atlantic coast of Nicaragua, is much more like going to Kingston, Jamaica, than it is going to what we think most Central American
countries. Isn't there a little section similar to that on the Atlantic coast in Guatemala, too?
A little bit, but that has somewhat withdrawn or seceded from Guatemala, and that's the country that we usually call Belize.
Okay.
Guatemalans still think Belize should be part of Guatemala, although internationally the world recognizes that as its own country.
What's the name of the port city that the big highway in Guatemala goes to on the Port of? Isn't there a harbor city there?
In Guatemala, the major ports are on the Pacific.
Yeah. Okay. Maybe it's in Belize now.
The next strata within Nicaragua would be those of the campesinos. These again are the peasant farmers. These certainly are basically Spanish speaking. They are predominantly Roman Catholic and so on. They personify in some sense what we might typically understand the poor of Central America to be. But again, within the Nicaraguan structure, they are one step, if you will, above these folks. For example, just in terms of unemployment and that, on the Atlantic coast, by and large, unemployment is understood to be at the level of 90%. When you go into the Pacific coast of Nicaragua, where most of the campesinos are, the small farms, whether it's around Managua or other cities like Matagalpa, Hinatego, or whatnot, if you will, life is much better there because unemployment is only running at about 55%. Now again, 55% unemployment is not good news, but you can at least see the stratification that is going on there, at least at these economic levels. The next level is kind of a newly created level of ex-soldiers and ex-contras, which again, both of them are soldiers. Why is this its own level? Because here at this level, what happened in the peace accord that was negotiated in Nicaragua after Violeta Chamorro took over in the government and so on and so forth, in order to try to demilitarize the country, and Nicaragua is one of the most successful places in Central America where the military does not hold the power anymore. And they have truly demilitarized in many senses. But one of the things they did in order to was promised that those soldiers who had fought for the Sandinista government, and even those soldiers who had been contra and fought against them, that they would be given their own small parcel of land. Now that is beginning to happen. And one of the issues within Nicaragua is that these soldiers and contras who have not yet received their land are saying, hey, when are we going to get our land? You promised that if we would give up our position in the army, right, that if we would take an honorable discharge, we would be given a plot of land that we and our family could live on and farm. We want it. Now that is happening. The thing that puts them a bit above the campesinos is that precisely because this is happening, they have something that many campesinos don't have, namely land that is paid for because it's given to them by the government. I mean, similar to things within the United States, let's say after the Civil War, like the Homestead Act. right? That if you had served in the army, you could go out there and, you know, you'd get your 100 acres and a mule, and that was, well, it's the same kind of program that Nicaragua is trying to initiate. And again, in a country where there is such poverty, to truly be given a land title and to have the land paid for such that it's yours is a tremendous boost in benefit economically to a sense of security and well-being of those people. So there again, a bit above Campesinos and others for whom the struggle for land and property rights and title and ownership is still a struggle. The next level again is a small middle class. And above that would be the government. Above that are the wealthy. And most of these wealthy do not live most of the year in Nicaragua. And most of the time they live in Miami. They fled to Miami in 1979, or maybe even a little earlier, with the downfall of Somoza. But they still own a tremendous amount of land and business within the country. And so, again, there's a close coalition between the government and these wealthy people, and they by and large call the shots because they control the money and the economy, what there is in the country. And then again, at the very top of the pyramid, this kind of cynical question that again lurks: how much does the U.S. call the shots? How much does the U.S. determine the policy and structures, the internal policy structures and economy within Nicaragua? One of the things that again would incline me to say yes, the U.S. is up here calling the shots is what is in front of Congress right now. It's known as the Helms-Gonzalez Bill. Does anyone know what the Helms-Gonzalez Bill is? I'm not surprised by that. It's, in terms of how it affects us in the United States, a most unimportant bill. I would doubt if it's received any press coverage whatsoever here in the States, and it doesn't concern us. But it is the bill that concerns the people of Nicaragua because it has to do with land reform again. What's happening in Nicaragua right now is a controversy over the land. What happened in 1979 when the Sandinistas took over is that all of the land and businesses that Somoza owned and that he either himself owned or gave to others within his family, which was about one-third of the agrable land in Nicaragua, was owned by Somoza. The Sandinista government took that over, declared that or expropriated it from Somoza and his family. Relatives declared that to be public land, government land, and that by and large is the land and businesses that they parceled out to campesinos and to people in the cities to form and run as cooperatives. So that the Somoza land was run as either land cooperatives or business cooperatives. And what the Sandinistas did, in one sense, not having a whole lot of political foresight, was simply by declaration saying, we as the government give you this land, it is now yours. It is your land. And the campesinos said, thank you. The people in the cities working with these businesses said, thank you. And they farmed the land, they worked in the businesses, so on and so forth. Now, surprise of surprises, what happens is that in 1990, with the elections, what the Sandinistas thought would be impossible became possible. In other words, they were defeated at the election. And the government of Violeta Chamorro, which again was a coalition called UNO, a coalition of 14 different political parties, but they all kind of rallied together in order to get a majority within the assembly, within the legislative assembly, and so they became the government. When they became the government, all these property and wealthy landowners who had been expropriated by the Sandinistas now came back and said, we want our land back, we want our businesses back, because we have the property titles. Campesinos never had property titles. The Sandinistas never thought it through or had enough time to legally give people title to the property. They had just simply declared it will be yours in perpetuity. But that perpetuity ended when a new government came in. And so now, within Nicaragua, there is a judicial nightmare. Because the campesinos, for example, like a land cooperative, they are going to the courts and said, look it, this land was given to us by the government. A new government cannot just come in and simply annul those kinds of agreements. I mean, there has to be honor in the treaties and the word that a government makes from election to election. I mean, we do that in our government. It's not that when President Clinton is elected, he says, well, everything President Bush said is annulled. All our treaties with everyone throughout the world and all the bills and everything that happens with the people in the United States, it's all annulled. No, there's a sense of continuity. They're arguing continuity. The wealthy who own this and have that to say, well, look it, we have legal title to this property. And a government like the Sandinistas cannot just arbitrarily and willy-nilly say, oh, legal property titles don't count anymore. We give away the land. We do anything we want with it. So now it's in the courts, and they're trying to figure out how to work this through. And they really are trying to work it through. They're trying to set up criteria, like, for example, can you receive some can these people, the wealthy, receive some adequate compensation for the land? Or can something happen such like if these people were seen at the time of the fall of Somoza to then let their land remain totally idle in order to drain the country of capital, then they're saying, you purposefully worked against this country. Because of that, right, you don't deserve the land anymore. Whereas if others within that group tried to stay within the country, work with the Sandinista government, try to again stabilize the economy of Nicaragua, they're saying, yes, you do have, you are trying to be a good Nicaraguan citizen. There should be some kind of justice for you as well. So they're trying to work it out. It's a tremendously messy situation, but they're trying to work it out. Now comes the Helms-Gonzalez bill. Senator Jesse Helms, Representative Henry Gonzalez from San Antonio, Mexico. And what the Helms-Gonzalez bill does is it wants to attach a little codicil to all USAID monies that go to Nicaragua, although it's more general. And it says, basically, that any government which does not honor property titles that belong to their respective citizens
should not be the recipient of USAID monies. So in other words, again, what's happening, well, through this little codicil attached to that, it by and large says, okay, Nicaragua, what's the policy you have to supply if you want to get U.S. aid in what you're doing? You've got to give that land back to the wealthy owners. No questions, no compromises, no deals. It goes back to them. That's what we want. So now you can see the government of Nicaragua is put into a real mess, because why? About one-third of its gross national product, or gross domestic product in terms of its budget right now, comes through USAID money. Can Nicaragua live by having to slash its entire national budget by a third? No. So you can see what kind of stranglehold this Helms-Gonzalez bill has on the people of Nicaragua. So who calls the shots? I'll let you decide.
Can you say a little bit about the judicial system in Nicaragua and how it's different from our separation of powers? In other words, I'm trying to, in an American-type system, I'm trying to visualize, for the sake of argument, even if the government wanted to do what the Helms bill says, the executive couldn't tell the courts what decision they had to come out with.
Right.
So how would that mechanically operate?
And that's the case here, too, that in one sense, the executive can't tell the courts how to decide. But on the other hand, right, again, look at, you have this threat, this external threat from the outside that basically says, unless you play the game by our rules, we're going to take your country down the economic tubes.
Has this passed?
No, it hasn't.
What's the Clinton administration's position on it?
Don't know.
Why is Henry Gonzalez lining up with Jesse Helms on it?
I don't know why that's the case and what's going on. Most folks, at least from down there, what they think that the Clinton position will be on this is that Clinton probably, with the quote-unquote art of compromise, which our government is all about, will let this go through in order to get Helms and Gonzalez on board for what he considers to be more important issues. Another reason that they think Clinton will let this go through is because another bunch of people backing this are the Cuban community in and around Miami, because they're kind of looking at this down the pike saying, well, you know, Castro's not going to be around forever, and when Cuba goes down and we get to go back, all these people down there will want money and aid. It would be nice to have a bill like this in place so that, right, we can all get our lands back again and so on and so forth. So that's...
Well, Castro, though, has had 35 years to grant land titles.
Yeah, but you see, well, I do not have a very high opinion of Jesse Helms. I will let that bias be known immediately. But you see, I don't think Jesse Helms gives a damn in terms of what happened the last 30 years in Cuba and what that means for people and so on and so forth. He is supported and he is on the side of those Cuban exiles and, again, that wealthy class that left Cuba. And so this is, but by putting bills like this, it again directly affects what happens in Nicaragua right now, and they hope will affect what happens in Cuba in the years to come, right? So that one can again rectify all the terrible consequences of what happened when communism had a foothold in the Western Hemisphere.
Doesn't it, I mean, I know on the one hand there's more than one way to skin a cat and they'd probably do it somehow anyway, but on the other hand, doesn't it seem like it was a strategic error for the Sandinista government not to go through the legal process of granting land titles? I mean, they did have 10 years.
Yes. Yes. Everyone will admit that now. But again, the Sandinistas, I mean, and as you talk to them, they never thought they were going to be voted out of office. And the other thing is that when it came to things to do, you grant these people the land, okay, that issue is taken care of. We have so many other things to do, right? First and foremost, to try and protect ourselves over against the Contra and the whole low-intensity warfare that the Reagan administration and the Bush administration fought against this country. So they were so busy and preoccupied with that kind of defense mechanism, with trying to make the economy work, with trying to establish and set up some kind of constitutional government, a mixed economy, all of those kinds of things, that in some senses, even though they had 10 years, they just never got around to it.
Could you talk about the election coming up in Nicaragua? I suppose it's not until, February of 96?
1996.
February 96.
Right.
Well, that's a year and a half away.
It's a year and a half away, and the political posturing has already begun. It looks like the election will again be... a whole bunch of groups of different parties will band together to form some coalition. Who knows what it will be? It may not be UNO this time, right? The acronym is yet to be invented. It looks like the prime candidate over here, or who will be in this coalition, will be the mayor of Nicaragua. Alamein, who was very close to Somoza and who is very much connected with the moneyed in Miami. That's how he got the monies needed to run his campaign for the mayor of Nicaragua. Again, it's very hard to substantiate, but the people with whom we talked, and I think they have a sense of what's going on, felt that he received over $1 million from the Nicaraguan Miami community to run his election for the mayor of Nicaragua. And again, one of his key tasks has always been to kind of de-Sandinistatize Managua, so that often many of the revolutionary murals, posters, statues, all of that, they all went down. They've been whitewashed over and all sorts of things. We've got to forget the Sandinistas. That's
where was he in the 80s?
His understanding. Huh?
Where was he in the 80s?
He was in Managua. He stayed. He was always opposed to the Sandinistas and what they were doing, but he always remained within the country as one of those opponents of the Sandinistas.
So Daniel Ortega will be the candidate of the Sandinistas again?
No, Ortega is the general secretary of the FMLN, which is again the Sandinista party, but he will not be running. There again, I think, on the one hand, he is very popular with the people, but on the other hand, there's that kind of sense of, one, he had his chance, and he is not a proven kind of government leader in terms of knowing how to put together and run an economy and things like that. And secondly, people are afraid to have him run because, again, he is so closely connected to, you know, communism and all of those kinds of things that they're afraid that if they elect Ortega, the United States is going to start the Contra War all over again and all of those kinds of things, and he's just not going to get the votes for the people. I mean, the reason he was voted out the last time was people were hoping, right, a change would mean the U.S. would end the Contra War. And economics would get better.
Is his brother still head of the military?
Yes.
Is he still considered a Sandinista?
Yes. And again, for example, someone like Alamein vows that if he is elected president, Ortega, General Ortega, head of the army, he'll go.
Who controls the military right now?
Who controls the military right now? Good question. I think by and large the military is willing to abide by what the government says. That here again, General Ortega's understanding, he is willing to live by the Constitution of Nicaragua. And he understands the military as basically that which is now to defend Nicaragua's borders. From 1990 until now, the military has gone from 90,000 to 15,000. And it probably will stabilize and remain at about 15,000. So again, it has been very intentional on the part of Ortega, but also one could say Sandinista policy as well. It has been very intentional to not have the military, even if it's their military, call the shots. They want to make this a democracy. Right. And where the people rule, where those who are elected rule, not the military. And they're trying very hard to do that, and I think, quite frankly, they're quite successful at it.
And that demilitarization partly just makes sense practically because the war isn't there anymore.
Right.
So you don't need.
Right. Demilitarization makes sense because the war isn't there. And again, if you can grant land to the soldiers, you really help this demilitarization process along. I mean, again, it's the kind of thing that I think outside of Costa Rica, which, you know, said already in 1948 they were not going to have any standing army, Nicaragua is a country where you see very few soldiers and people with guns around anymore. Everywhere else you go, there are always soldiers and guns in Central America, but not in Nicaragua. And in that sense, one of the lasting things of the Sandinista revolution and what has happened is freedom of expression. To speak your mind in Guatemala could mean your death. To organize and to protest could mean your death. Not in Nicaragua. There are no death squads in Nicaragua. You're not afraid of being picked up by the army and so on and so forth. People protest, demonstrate. I mean, it goes on all the time. I mean, maybe there the problem is that someone wonders, is anybody listening? Does anyone care? But certainly, the people of Nicaragua speak their minds. And I think in that sense, one can say, here is where there has been a significant change in Nicaragua, and there is that process of democratization, and there is that opening up of freedoms for people. Economically, it's still the pits. Right, no question about that. In fact, I think economically, they're worse now than they've ever been. So that, I mean, that interesting thing that, yes, you get Violeta Chamorro in a group that is friendly to the United States, and the United States is going to come in and help them and all of that kind of stuff. Certainly, it did end the war. But the U.S. program for how to economically get Nicaragua back on its feet. I talked about that a little bit yesterday again. That whole sense of structural adjustment is an abysmal failure. It has made economic times tougher than ever for the Nicaraguan people.
So you don't think the Sandinistas have a chance even with that kind of?
Oh, yes, I do. I think what is important there is who will come out of the Sandinista rank and file or leadership group now to be their candidate. I mean, I think, again, if you will, if they can get a candidate that is popular with the people and perceived as non-threatening to the United States, and that's a kind of interesting mix, right? But if they can get that kind of person, I think the chances are very good that the Sandinistas will win.
Well, Jim Hoyos, who was the camp pastor here, was an observer at the elections.
In Nicaragua, yeah, in 1990?
And if I remember, he said that some of the people said that they voted for Chamorro because they wanted the economic and military pressure that the United States was applying to stop, that they wanted.
Yes. I think most people would say that's their primary reason for voting for Chamorro.
So it wasn't so much a positive vote for her as well, we should vote for her at least this time so we can get the United States off her back.
That's right. It was a vote to get the U.S. off their back. And the thing is that only half happened. Right, the U.S. is off their back in terms of the Contra war is over. So indeed, that war. But economically, the situation hasn't improved. And so because of that, again, they're in that tricky business about, right, can we, one, vote for the person we want, but again, make sure that that person will not be perceived as somehow threatening to the United States and its policies and its influences, because we know what happens when the U.S. doesn't like what we decide as a people. Right? I mean, so again, it's that kind of cynical question, who really calls the shots in Nicaragua? Who really has the power?
It sounds from what you're saying that the Chamorro government has been honorable to the extent that they really aren't Somoza in disguise. I mean, it sounds like the balance of power is such that, generally speaking, Nicaragua right now really is somewhere between where it was under Somoza and where it was under the Sandinistas. Is that accurate?
Yes. In Nicaragua, they refer to Violeta Chamorro as Doña Violeta. Right, which is again kind of, you know, the way you would refer to the woman who heads the hacienda, right? And so she is certainly kind of the woman with the kind heart, the compassionate one. And so they all recognize that in many senses she wishes to be compassionate toward the people of Nicaragua. She's not going to be heavy-handed and dictatorial and coercive like a Somoza. On the other hand, they recognize in some senses that she is a figurehead. She is not going to make and set policy like the Sandinistas ever did, which intentionally is going to try to change and restructure things. She's going to, in some senses, try to make this structure work as compassionately as possible. But there again, right, one has to ask the question, is this ever a compassionate structure? Finally, is this ever a compassionate structure?